It's the lens of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Presta in the afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO. Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO. Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Welcome back to Church and Culture. My guest for this hour is Greg Khalil. Greg's a good friend. He is president and co-founder of the Telos Group, which is a group devoted to bringing about peace between Israel and occupied Palestine. He's lived in Ramallah, that is the capital city of Palestine on the West Bank, where for nearly 4 years he advised Palestinian leadership on their peace negotiations with Israel. He was born and raised in San Diego. However, his very large and extended family, many of whom I have met, live in a city next to Bethlehem called Beit Sahor, which is predominantly Palestinian Christian. Greg himself is Orthodox Christian. And I met Greg on my very first trip of five trips to the Holy Land, and he showed me all around, introduced me to everyone. And he is a very knowledgeable, informed commentator on the situation there, which is always so fragile. Greg, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thanks for having me, Teal. It's an honor.
Well, it's an honor to have you, too, because I really don't know anyone who can speak more eloquently, wisely, and fairly, which is the most important thing, about this ongoing conflict that could erupt at any time and has erupted in the past between the nation of Israel and the Palestinians who live under Israeli occupation for now. How many years has that gone on?
Well, since 1967.
Yeah. That's the longest military occupation in modern history. But we don't want to start right there. I want to start, Greg, and what I found out from you and the people you've introduced me to over the years about the situation in Israel, you know, is basically everybody wants to get things settled. People do not want more war, more death, more terrorism. The people on the ground that I've met, that you've introduced me to on both sides of the wall, they want to see some sort of end to this now nearly, 60 years of conflict. Is that a real possibility, Greg?
Well, I think the short answer to that is yes, but I think it's also a little bit more complicated. The conflict has its origins more than 100 years ago, and if we jump forward to today, I think you see a trend that the majority of Israelis and Palestinians, majority of all people on the ground, are like people everywhere. They don't want conflict. And if you look at the polling today, the majorities of both Israelis and Palestinians support a two-state solution, even, which is the current resolution to the conflict that's backed by the international community. However, the majority of them don't believe that's going to happen. They just don't believe they're going to see peace in their lifetimes. So I think that there's an interesting disjunct between the aspirations of many people and the reality that they live under. And I think it's also important to say that, you know, while the vast majority of Israelis and Palestinians and other interested parties do want peace, there are clearly those who do not. And that's a key reason why we still have this conflict.
Greg, let's go back to the origins of the conflict, which, of course, predate the UN partition of 1947, the subsequent civil war. They go back really to the way in which the territory we know as Palestine was divided up after World War I. Could you go over that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd even start a little bit earlier. Of course, everything is up under incredible scrutiny and debate regarding this conflict, including, if not especially, the history. Some people have it going back thousands of years and frame it very much as a biblical conflict. I think most historians will identify the modern conflict between Israelis and Palestinians as really having its origins in the late 19th century. You have the rise of nationalism in Europe, and during this time, the territory that we call Israel, West Bank, Gaza Strip, large swaths of the Middle East, they were under the control of the Ottoman Empire and had been for 400 years. That empire was disintegrating, and going into World War One, the Western powers, namely Britain, France, they were looking at this disintegrating Ottoman Empire, saw the access to trade routes and saw important natural resources in the region. And after World War One, they emerged victorious and sort of carved up the entire Middle East, not just the Holy Land, and created many of which were new states that were under their respective control under these mandates for a period of time.
So, just to underscore something, the area we now know as the Middle East, which contains Israel, Lebanon, Jordan, these states didn't exist. They were created artificially, correct?
Yeah, and there's that actually interesting story there. You had two generals, one a Brit and one a French general, Sykes and Picot, and they had the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which pretty much laid out sort of this new Middle East. And if you look at a map of the modern Middle East, you'll see many of the countries, like Iraq, for example, will have, and Jordan, will have these straight lines as borders. And the reason for that is that literally these countries' borders were drawn with rulers. So you wonder why we have a lot of conflict in the Middle East today. Many people would say that some of it goes back to the end of World War One, with the creation of these new sort of quote-unquote nation states that didn't really develop generatively or organically, and in fact were kind of imposed upon groups of people that didn't see themselves entirely as a nation the way that many other nation states during this time around the world did.
Well, one thing I noticed, Greg, in reviewing my history is that the British plan from the very beginning was to move over 200,000 Arabs from their homes, no telling how many hundreds of years they lived there, and to just replant them somewhere else. Now, this in itself, that creates conflict for generations. I mean, didn't they understand that at the time? Did they just think you could take a quarter of a million people and move them on your own authority?
Well, during this period of history, you did see population transfers that were enacted in other parts of the world. That most famously in the 40s was between, of course, India and Pakistan. And so we saw a huge sort of recognition, primarily beginning again during the same period of history, the end of the 19th century, with the need for some sort of baseline consensus regarding human rights norms. And that's really sort of the beginning of the modern body of international human rights law, which is not particularly a robust body of law right now, but this is sort of when it came into being. And part of the reason for the development of these norms was the recognition, like you say, that sometimes large population transfers don't actually lead to increased security, but create entrenched conflicts that often last generations. Another example of sort of the recognition of the interplay of human rights and national security interests was with refugee crises. And this was true in the late 19th century after World War One, and particularly after World War II. One of the most destabilizing factors in geopolitics today, and we see this again in the Middle East, unfortunately, with the crisis in Syria, which is bleeding out over its borders into neighboring countries, is when you have extreme internal conflict in one country that creates these large flows of refugees that cross international borders. Those flows of refugees create lots of problems for the neighboring countries. And so what you saw increasingly in the first half of the 20th century is this recognition that sometimes while we want to preference state sovereignty and give states, you know, as much independence as possible, when states begin violating the rights of their own citizens or when there are these massive civil conflicts that erupt in states, they don't stay isolated for very long, and they tend to sort of bleed out into neighboring countries. We saw the same thing with in the Holy Land with the creation of the Palestinian refugee problem, and also there were Jewish refugees from Arab states. But around the creation of Israel in 1948, around its War of Independence, which is also called the Palestinian Nakba, about three-quarters of the Palestinian Christian and Muslim population there at the time fled or were expelled from their homes and not allowed to return. And you still have sort of this festering refugee crisis today, with many of these refugees and their descendants still living in refugee camps around the Middle East, now numbering in the millions.
You know, moving forward a little bit to the UN partition itself, which, again, as I review the history, was really the culmination of a number of partition plans, mostly British, correct?
Well, the first partition plan was in 1937 with Lord Peel, and that was during the Arab Revolt.
The so-called Peel Commission?
The Peel Commission, yeah. And that in fact, did actually call for some sort of population transfer, which was rejected by many parties. The 1947 partition plan was a culmination of a number of trends. I mean, obviously, one of the big trends here that we haven't even discussed yet was the development or sort of the rise of Jewish nationalism, a.k.a. Zionism, at the end of the 19th century.
Yeah, Theodor Herzl and other important
exactly.
figures.
And that was a relatively new movement, but it was an incredibly powerful movement with a lot of momentum, because if you'll recall, persecution of the Jewish people, particularly in Europe, had increased steadily over this time. It wasn't, unfortunately, far into history. As we know, the Jewish people have been persecuted for for centuries, even millennia. And Zionism was sort of a response to European nationalism in its modern iteration, to say that, hey, look, you know, there's these nation states like France developing, Italy, Germany, a state of French people get a state of their own. And look, we as Jews, we're seen as outsiders, as outcasts in our own countries, even if we're full citizens, even if we participate fully in civic life. So Zionism was a response that, hey, if we're going to be outcasts, maybe what we need to do is we need to take our own future into our own hands. And obviously that became a lot more urgent during the first part of the 20th century.
Exactly.
As the persecution against the Jewish people didn't diminish but rather increased, resulting in such horrors as, of course, the Holocaust, which ended only in 1945. So 2 years after the Holocaust, the United Nations formally sort of endorsed Zionism by calling for the Holy Land, mandate, the Palestine mandate, which includes Israel and West Bank and Gaza Strip today, to be partitioned into two states. It was a recommendation, one a Jewish state, one an Arab state.
But I noticed that part of the recommendation was that all the Arabs in the Arab state would be citizens of the Jewish state, and all the Jews in the Jewish state would be citizens of the Arab state.
The recommendation did call, though, for the establishment of sort of two nation states, and that's sort of the basis.
But they were intended to be economically joined and obviously to be peaceful neighbors.
They were intended to be economically joined. That's true. But the broader sort of stroke here is that I think that if you see that moment in history through two different perspectives, you see two very different stories. And one is sort of the Zionist story, which is incredible triumph and, in fact, miracle. Because if you see, if you look at the timing, just 2 years after the last gas chamber closed, I mean, that's quite remarkable to think that here this almost defeated, almost exterminated people was somehow able to recreate a nation, get endorsement by the United Nations, and to do so in the birthplace of Judaism, historic Palestine. So the Palestinians, who have their own narrative and who see themselves like, you know, my family does, who are Palestinian Christians, will say that, hey, you know, we trace ourselves back to Pentecost, and, you know, maybe we were Jewish, but we heard the word of Jesus from his disciples, and we've been here too. And many Muslim families who have family trees in Jerusalem, for example, unbroken for 1,500 years, they'll say, we're just as much a part of this land, if not more a part of this land, having lived here continuously for this period of time. And the rise of Zionism, while it can be understandable given all of the horrors that were being suffered by the Jewish people during this time, that doesn't sort of justify what happened to us and sort of the disintegration of our own communities. And so many Palestinians, rather than viewing Israel's independence and the partition plan, which predated the independence by about a year, a little less than a year, as some great miraculous event, they view it very much as the Nakba, which in Arabic means the catastrophe, sort of the beginning of this period of insecurity, instability, unfamiliarity in their own land where they don't have control over their rights, their future, their own resources.
Well, I notice I'm talking with Greg Khalil, whose family goes way back in the town of Beit Sahur next to Bethlehem, just outside Jerusalem, Christian family. And, of course, a lot of people forget that when you say the word Arab, you're including Christians as well. There are Arab Christians around the world. A lot of Arab Christians in the area in which this radio broadcast is being made out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And the simple fact is that the partition that was created immediately sparked a civil war because the Arab leaders never agreed to the partition in the first place. Isn't that the case?
Well, tensions that had been happening between Jews and Arabs increased with the partition plan significantly. And that culminated in 1948 when the Brits, who had been in charge of this territory under the British Mandate ever since pretty much the end of World War I, left, and Israel declared its independence. To call it a civil war, I think, is an interesting term, and many people would term it as such. Others would debate it. The reason why they would debate that term is, for if you look at sort of the Palestinian narrative, many Palestinians would say, "Look, we all used to speak Arabic. We share the same culture. We share the same language. We lived under the Ottoman Empire for many hundreds of years. It's not that everybody was singing Kumbaya and things were perfect, but people saw themselves as part of the same community." During sort of the rise of Zionism and then increased immigration, in particular from Europe and also some Middle Eastern countries, but primarily from Europe, you saw increased tensions and sort of this cleavage of identity, where neighbors who once saw themselves as connected to each other in some way saw themselves as quite different. And the local populations very much felt that the new immigrants who didn't speak the local languages, who had very much different cultures, were part of a larger enterprise. In fact, many would call it almost like a colonialist enterprise, although obviously Israelis would very much debate that particular point. But that did culminate in Israel's Declaration of Independence on 1948, which the war began in earnest, even though hostilities had increased from November 1947, and continued all the way through 1949 with the armistice.
Well, the Arab side of the war, is it true to say that they simply got outgunned, outmanned, outstrategized? From my reading of that initial war, 1948, the Arab armies were not united in their response to the Jewish soldiers.
No, they weren't. I think there was a consensus on hostility to the establishment of the State of Israel, but it wasn't it wasn't a particularly well-coordinated war on the Arab side.
And that also repeated itself, that pattern seemed to repeat itself throughout the series of wars between Israel and the Arab states that are contiguous to it.
That's true. I think that it's beyond dispute that just from a pure military perspective, even though Israel is a very small country, it has been successful at waging and winning a number of wars, with just one notable exception, with its Arab neighbors. I think most famously, other than 1948, is 1967. Because after sort of the armistice of the 1948 war, you had the Holy Land, and I'm using the term here to describe what we call Israel today, what we call the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Israel was this new state. It was established on 78% of that historic Palestine area, which was an area larger than had been recommended for Israel in the partition plan. And then the West Bank, which means the West Bank of the Jordan River, that was under Jordanian control or occupation, and the Gaza Strip during this time was under Egyptian control or occupation. So that was the scenario at the end of Israel's War of Independence, the Palestinian Nakba in 1949, and in 1967, the Six-Day War, as it's often called, again Israel fought its Arab neighbors, and it emerged victorious, and as the name might suggest, less than a week, and it came into control of both the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, also some additional territory in what is now Syria and Lebanon and Egypt. But of primary concern to the negotiations that we see going on today is the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and that's when the military occupation that you were referring to earlier, which is also a term that some people dispute, but pretty much the entire international community says
they dispute the word occupation.
There are some. I think it's an interesting sort of conversation.
It'd be pretty hard to go over there, yeah, take a look, and then dispute it.
Right, and it's also interesting too, because if you go over there, I mean, you see the reality where people's lives are controlled by a military that's not their own, and by a government that they don't have voting rights in. And you also look at, Israeli jurisprudence, for example. The Israeli Supreme Court still considers Israel an occupying force in the West Bank. But there are many voices here in the States and in Israel who will very stridently debate the use of the word occupation.
What do they prefer?
They prefer disputed territory.
Oh, okay. Well, it's funny how much of politics is concerned with creating words that sort of distort the reality on the ground. I'm talking to Greg Khalil, who himself comes from a Palestinian Christian family near Bethlehem. He's been working in Palestine and Israel now. How many years ago did you start advising the Palestinian Authority?
I guess that was about 10 years ago.
And you attended some of these conferences and negotiations with the U.S. president, right?
Well, I was at Annapolis, Maryland, in
at the Y River conference,
2007. I was not at Y River, and that's sort of a former chapter of my life. I haven't done that for many years.
Well, we're not trying to paint you as partisan. Because the listeners can take it from me, I've known Greg now for over 10 years. I've been in the Holy Land with him 5 times. And I can tell you there is no more fair arbiter of this argument, of this dispute, than Greg. In fact, if you get Greg in the room with the leading political reporter for Haaretz, our mutual friend, they would agree on most things. Akiva Eldar, wouldn't you say that's the case, Greg?
Well, he no longer works for Haaretz. I mean, I think there's...
Where does he work now?
Many points. He works for the Al Monitor.
Okay.
Al-Hyphen.
Thanks for telling me that.
Yep. You're welcome. I mean, I think there are many things that we would agree on. I really appreciate your compliment. I think, you know, one of the things that's been lacking in this issue is providing platforms for people who hear about it all the time, but who don't know what's going on, to at least hear the different perspectives about the conflict and to get some sense of the realities of on the ground as well, rather than sort of making polemical arguments one way or the other. I mean, obviously I have some very strong personal beliefs about it, but I think oftentimes it's better to try and provide opportunities for others to actually...
Well, you have charity. I want to tell our listeners that Greg's organization, Telos, actually takes various religious leaders and political leaders to the Holy Land, to Israel, to the West Bank, and holds briefings with leaders on both sides, and has had a lot of success in doing exactly what he just said, and that is giving people the whole picture rather than just part.
Well, thanks, Dale. We actually just finished our 44th trip, a little under 4 years doing...
And I've only been on one of those. I'm just so upset. How can I say? But, you know, 44, that's a lot of people, and that's a lot of influence. So congratulations.
Well, thank you.
And I know it's caught the eye of some folks who take another point of view with you. In fact, I've had Pastor John Hagee on this very show. So you might say that we're restoring the balance, you know, at this very moment. I'm talking with Greg Khalil about the ongoing and deadly crisis in Israel, in Palestine, of the occupation of Palestine by Israel since 1947. When we come back, since 1967, thank you, Greg, the original conflict started in 47-48 when the Jews who lived in the Palestine area declared themselves a state. Is that not correct?
Yes. I mean, I think it goes...
Is there a better way of putting it?
I think that's accurate.
Okay. I know whenever we talk about this, we always have to get our language right, because it is a highly controversial subject and the words count. So... we'll be back in a moment to talk more about Israel and Palestine.
One in three Americans deal directly or indirectly with alcohol or substance abuse in their lifetime. If you're dependent and contemplating help, start listening to Renewing Hope every Saturday at noon on Ave Maria Radio. Renewing Hope is an information gateway to overcoming dependency. Brought to you by the St. Gregory Retreat Center, they want to help. Send your comments and questions without obligation to Renewing Hope at AveMariaRadio.net. And all audio archives can be found at our website at AveMariaRadio.net.
The greatest story ever told comes alive on stage.
He's alive! He's alive!
It's the cross and the light. See it April 10th through Palm Sunday, April 13th in Music Hall. You'll love the singing, featuring Sunday Best winner, Tasha Page Lockhart. Plus, Capitol recording artist Tim Pullman Jr. See what over 7,000 people love. It's the cross and the light. Get tickets at Ticketmaster.com or go online to thecrossandthelight.com.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those that find it are few. This verse from chapter 7 of Matthew's Gospel is one of the hard sayings of Jesus. Jesus couldn't be more clear, and yet we want to believe what the world says. Broad is the way to heaven, and almost everyone gets there. Narrow is the way to hell, and hardly anyone ends up there, maybe serial killers. This idea of universalism, that everyone will be saved because they are good people, is just the opposite of what our Lord is saying in the gospel. We can use this idea to justify our lack of evangelization. If everyone is going to heaven, why bother? But if Jesus is serious, it's time for us to become the witnesses we were created to be.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Welcome back to Church and Culture. We're talking about Israel and Palestine, the ongoing conflict there, with Greg Khalil, the founder and president of the Telos Group, an organization devoted to taking people in leadership positions, both political and religious, to the Holy Land, and to get a fuller picture of what's going on over there. You know, Greg, the thing that brought me to the Holy Land the first time in 2004 was specifically reports about the diminishing presence of Christians on the West Bank, that is, Christian Arabs, whether they're Roman Catholic or Orthodox or Evangelical. And when I went over there, I found, indeed, it was the case that Christians were leaving, children were leaving their families, not coming back. The occupation, the building of the wall and the checkpoints was making life so difficult for everyone, but also for Christians, that the number of Christians, the number of Christian communities were drastically reduced. What is the situation there now, Greg?
Well, it's true that historically there's been a much more significant presence of Christians in the Holy Land, including Israel, West Bank, Gaza Strip. And that presence is diminishing over the past decades. Many Christians find their situation incredibly difficult. And by their situation, I'm referring to the Israeli occupation, as well as being minorities in their respective cultures. And many Christians, because of the good involvement and good works of the church historically in the region, have had connections to the West. So many Christians who can leave actually do end up leaving. So what we've seen is a pretty dramatic decline in sort of the public presence of the Christian population on the ground. And there's lots of, you know, anecdotes, some of which are true, about the number of, you know, Palestinian Christians in certain cities like San Francisco or in places like Chile, outnumbering the actual Christian populations of the villages that they originally come from. So just to put things in perspective, seen numbers estimating from between about 12% of the population 100 years ago to 20%. I think the 12% figure is actually more accurate, down to 1.2% today. Dramatic declines, not just in percentage, but also in number in places like Jerusalem, which about 60 years ago had 29,000 Christians, and today the estimates are between 9 and 15,000. You're seeing some rise, like in Bethlehem, for example, and the actual numbers of Christians there, but it's a very small increase in actual numbers and a continued decrease proportionally, sort of just slightly stemming the tide against this larger story of a hemorrhaging of the Christian population.
Let me ask you about two things that you often hear when you talk to people about the Christian situation in the Holy Land. The first thing you hear is that there's a large, growing, and happy group of Christians in Israel proper, and that there's no problem living there as a Christian, and there's no any kind of harassment. And the second thing you hear is that the reason Christians are leaving the Holy Land are because of Muslim harassment and Muslim violence. What would you say to both of those things?
Well, to the first question, I mean, I think that look around sort of the larger Middle East, there are huge sort of earthquakes shaking the entire region and horrific wars, and Christians have actually suffered quite dramatically in neighboring countries. And you don't see the same situation in either Israel or the West Bank or the Gaza Strip today.
So it's nothing like Iraq.
It's nothing like Iraq or Syria, for example. In Israel specifically, you do have growing numbers of Christians, as I mentioned, as you do in the West Bank. When you're talking about Palestinian Christians specifically, however, 20% of Israel's population are Palestinians, are Palestinian Arabs, and about 9% of that population is Christian. You do see, though, the same sort of decrease in sort of the proportional representation of the Christian community inside Israel. And many Palestinian Christians who are citizens of Israel do not report enjoying sort of free ability to exercise their their religious liberties. And in fact, if you look at Jerusalem, which of course has been under Israeli control since 1967, you do see the very acute situation with the health of the indigenous Christian community there in Jerusalem itself. So I'm not
isn't that because of the demolition of Christian homes, Christian areas in West Jerusalem and the building of resettler dwellings?
No. I think the larger issue in Jerusalem comes back. Sort of Jerusalem was divided between 1949 and 1967, and you did have departure of Palestinian Christians during the Nakba, sort of around the creation of the State of Israel from Jerusalem as well as other parts of the territory. You had some more Christians flee during the Jordanian occupation, and then since 1967, you've had additionally a very difficult situation for the Christian population in Jerusalem as well. So you hear situation in Israel is good. It's certainly better than neighboring countries, but that does not mean that the Palestinian Christian community or the Israeli citizens of Israel who are Palestinian Christians have an easy situation that cannot be significantly improved, which it could be. And your second question was about Muslim persecution. Is that correct?
Yes. In other words, yeah. Is part of the loss of Christian presence due to a rise in Muslim persecution that, you know, would not have been the case 30 or 40 years ago, but is now?
Yes. I think the accurate way to answer that question is that there are tensions between Muslims and Christians in Palestinian areas, but they're not the predominant reason for the exodus of Palestinian Christians in recent decades. If you recall, sort of, if you look at the Holy Land on a map, it's really quite startling. It's literally at the intersection of three continents. This is sort of the birthplace of civilization: Europe, Asia, Africa. The Holy Land has always been a place of sort of cultural connection and intersection, and it's always been a place of some friction. What that has meant is it's historically been multicultural, and the Holy Land specifically has known how to accommodate a variety of different groupings of people, and it doesn't mean that everybody likes each other or gets along, but it kind of works, and it's worked for long stretches of history before.
Well, not even the Christians like each other.
Yeah, that's true.
Go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the different groups are fighting each other all the time.
Well, it's a lot like the Christianity here in the Middle East. Here in America, I'm saddened to say there's unfortunately a lot of division. But in fact, I'd say that people are at the local level, people are much more connected since you have denominational heads locally on the ground in the Holy Land, but many of the families among the Christians are intermarried across denominations and feel a strong sense of sort of larger identity which transcends their specific Christian denomination. So getting back to your question about, are Palestinian Christians fleeing sort of Muslim persecution, I don't think that's a fair representation of the reality on the ground, even though there are some tensions that have existed between those communities, and unfortunately some of those tensions are growing as Christians look around to the rest of the Middle East and feel increasingly vulnerable and isolated. The majority of Christians have been leaving because of the conflict, which inspires many Muslims who can leave and many Israeli Jews as well who can leave to leave. They don't like living in this sort of exacerbated tense situation, and many who have the choice to leave do so. That said, many try to stay, and many see great pride in living in the birthplace of their Savior, and living in Bethlehem or Jerusalem, which are such incredibly evocative and holy places. And so many choose to endure, even if they have the choice to leave.
You know, I must say that now that you're talking about what a wonderful place it is to live, if you're willing to put up with the occupation and so forth, I'm reminded of how precious my weeks have been that I've spent there, especially in Bethlehem and Beth Sahur, your family's stomping ground. If someone's listening right now who has planned some time to go to the Holy Land to make that pilgrimage, You know, what are the couple of things that they need to do that they probably don't know about, or their tour guide probably didn't tell them about? You know, that's not on the itinerary. What is the sort of short list of things to do?
Well, I'd say wherever they are, make sure if you can to try and meet with real people. I think that's sort of really what makes a visit to the Holy Land or any place much more meaningful than just going
to the tourist place.
Disneyland kind of a tourist trip. And unfortunately, you know, it's kind of ironic, Gil, because when you think about it, the one place in the world that most Christians don't go on pilgrimage is actually the Holy Land, because when they go to Israel, when they go to the Palestinian territory, they often get on these buses and they, you know, eat at these troughs at these hotels with really
these
not
horrible
great
places.
Food. And then they go and they read scripture in these very, you know, beautiful, important places, but, you know, and talk about architecture in a relatively modern church. That's not a model of Christian pilgrimage. That's something else. And I think that it's...
Well, it's the imposition of a American form of worship on the place where Christianity itself was born.
Yeah, and I think that the number one thing that people could do is to actually connect with local people from all perspectives, and to try and actually, you know, not just sort of read about the teachings of Jesus, but imagine how they might live them in this world more sort of effectively, and to do that by really connecting with a variety of people on all sides of the issue, kind of like Jesus did in John 4 when he met the Samaritan woman at the well, this enemy woman who was unclean. And, of course, that was one of the first times in the gospel that he revealed to anyone, someone not from his own tribe, but the other, the one he was not supposed to engage with, that, in fact, he was the Son of God.
I've met a number of people in recent years, Greg, who have made their trip to the Holy Land and not even had Bethlehem on their itinerary. They were told it was too dangerous. What do you say to that kind of thing?
Well, that's an unfortunate message that has been communicated. Bethlehem is not statistically dangerous. In fact, many American cities are probably more statistically dangerous.
Like Washington, D.C., for example.
Yeah. So I'd suggest that, you know, people to go with groups or tours, because it's hard to actually get in and out of Bethlehem if you just rented a car, and it's hard to drive around.
Unfortunately, so it has a wall around what, three of the four sides, or?
Yeah, it's a system of walls and fence and military roads.
Settlements.
Separating. Yeah, and the settlements. In fact, settlements are almost encircle the town of Bethlehem. But the wall itself, that people refer to, is a concrete wall that actually winds itself into the city of Bethlehem itself, into the outskirts of the city of Bethlehem itself. But the majority of it is actually sort of this system of fences and trenches and military roads around much of Bethlehem. That said, though, I mean, there's so much more to see in Bethlehem besides the conflict and other places, the West Bank and in Israel. I'd strongly suggest your listeners, if they're going to the Holy Land, you know, in addition to connecting to people, make sure they get off the beaten track, say, in Bethlehem, for example. Many tourists who go to Bethlehem will come into Bethlehem on a big bus, use it to roads, stop at Church of Nativity, go down into sort of the grotto, maybe a soda or a meal. They won't spend the night there. They won't eat there. And so here's this incredibly depressed economy that, in fact, sort of ends up hosting tourists. They have to pay for that infrastructure to upkeep the city.
So all those buses going in and out.
Exactly. And it's quite difficult for a community where you have a majority of the community living under poverty line. There's wonderful food there. There's a lot to do sort of in the hills around Bethlehem. There's some wonderful sort of sites like Mar Saba Monastery, a 1,600-year-old monastery in the Kidron Valley.
Well, you have the Franciscan University, Bethlehem University.
Yeah, and then you have the Vatican-sponsored University, which loves to welcome Catholic pilgrims.
They're wonderful to visitors.
Yeah.
They love to show off their university there, but they also love to introduce you to the students they will arrange for you to sit down and talk to the students, and you'll get an earful, but you'll actually find out what's really going on.
Yeah.
I remember when we took Congressman Chris Smith to talk with four of the students at Bethlehem University. I think it was the first time a member of Congress had ever visited Bethlehem University personally. And Congressman Smith had just spent the night in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and had come up to Bethlehem with us to meet with these students. And he heard a whole different narrative of the Holy Land than he had heard, been hearing on the Hill.
Well, you know, once you get on the ground, it's a really sort of different experience to actually be there and to connect with people. And primarily, if you do that intentionally from a values base, if you're a Christian and you actually want to go on a real pilgrimage and connect with people and consider how, say, the Beatitudes. I mean, if you go, you got to go up to the Sea of Galilee and the Mount of Beatitudes and try and consider how we might actually live those teachings out rather than sort of looking at them as pity and beautiful sayings in Jesus' greatest sermon. You know, in addition to the Sea of Galilee, a wonderful place to visit that nobody goes to, and I think it's an absolute shame, is actually Jacob's Well, where Jesus met the Samaritan woman.
Why don't they go there?
It's in Nablus, biblical Shechem, and it's really far off the beaten path. But there's a really interesting story there with the local Greek Orthodox priest who basically rebuilt the church by hand, and a remarkable artist, and serves the local community and has done so for decades.
But there's no danger involved in going to Nablus, right?
There are tensions in that area, so it's important to sort of go with a group that has coordinated beforehand to make sure that everything's okay. But it's incredible sort of.
Well, I remember Greg when you took me to Hebron, and I think we were with Fred Barnes on that trip. We had taken him over there, and with Colin Hanna, our friend. And now that was a town you could feel tension in, definitely.
Yes. Hebron is a very interesting place. You have the Tomb of the Patriarchs in the center of the town in the Old City, and then, you know, which is evocative to people of all faiths, all monotheistic.
But an incredibly important town for Jews.
It is, and you have, you know, at the Tomb of the Patriarchs, it's a smaller version of what the Second Temple probably looked like. It was actually built by King Herod. But right around sort of this core, this historic core, you have the most sort of visible presence of the conflict, in my view. There's an area where Palestinians have been living as well for many centuries, and now they're not allowed to actually walk on many of these streets. More than 1,000 of the stores were shut down. You have the settlers living in the middle of Hebron, and about 600 settlers, I think, is the current estimate right there. You have wiring over many of the Palestinian streets in this incredibly tense environment.
Mm-hmm.
The settlers will say that, hey, look, you know, we're reclaiming this land, but Arab neighbors who are hostile to Jewish presence here, they've tried to kick us out, so what are we going to do? We're going to stay here, and, you know, we're not leaving. Meanwhile, the Palestinians are, hey, look at these settlers. There was a time, you know, when many, 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 you know, for 100 years ago when things were better, and we're just as much part of this town, and these are our prophets who are buried here as well, and why is it that we can't walk down our own streets or even drive down certain streets and live in sort of this highly militarized area in which we have no life. And you'll see a number of the human rights groups that work on this this issue really take Hebron as sort of an exemplar of the larger occupation, because everything is so close together and so sort of explicit that, you know, one group of people has protection and rights, and another group of people living pretty much in the same system has a different set of rights based on who they are. And so it's a very, very tense area to visit, despite sort of the incredible history.
But I would urge people to go there, and I would urge people to, like you say, get off the beaten track, get to Annapolis, get to Ramallah, get up to Nazareth, you know, certainly get into Bethlehem. And I
the Haifa, and also, you know, Tel Aviv.
Beautiful
and
town. Tel Aviv's a beautiful town.
We're down by the Gaza border with Sderot and Netiv HaSarat, which are some really interesting Israeli communities.
It's a Mediterranean sea coast. I mean, it's gorgeous. I mean, people forget that. And, you know, we have 5 minutes left, Greg. I'm talking with Greg Khalil about Israel and Palestine, and he's the founder president of the Telos Group, who has taken now 42, you said, groups? 42?
44.
44 groups to the Holy Land to get a bigger picture, a fuller picture of what's going on over there. Can you, in the last few minutes here, summarize the state of play over there? You know, bring us all up to date on what. And we now have the Syrian threat. We have now the Iran threat. We have, some of the things that were hot when I was there, like Gaza, aren't as hot. We have other hot spots. So bring us up to date on what's going on.
Well, I think the most urgent thing right now is Secretary of State John Kerry is making a big push for a two-state solution to sort of formalize and finalize what we were talking about, the partition plan earlier, and create a secure state, safe state of Israel as a homeland for the Jewish people, and a secure state of Palestine on the West Bank and Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip with East Jerusalem as its capital, as a national home for the Palestinian people. That's his agenda right now, and he's been pushing that forward forcefully. So what are the likelihoods of success of that? I think that, you know, many people are quite skeptical of this process. I think not least of which are Israelis and Palestinians, the majority of whom actually do support a two-state solution and have consistently supported a two-state solution for many years now, but an even larger majority of whom don't believe they're ever going to see it in their lifetimes. So what are the chances of success? I think Secretary Kerry is really sort of doubling down on this issue. He's been pushing forward to the Iranian negotiations, which is of great concern to Israel and Israel's security, at the same time as he's been pushing forward the peace process. I see an incredible amount of skepticism right now, which is not necessarily doesn't actually necessarily bode ill for the success of the negotiations. Many times before, and many of the processes that I've been involved in, publics had great expectations on the specific outcome of the set of negotiations, only to have their hopes dashed, which created a much tenser situation on the ground. You don't have that same investment of hope right now, which almost paradoxically means that Secretary Kerry, like, actually has some room to move. And he has been moving. I have to admit that I was very skeptical when this process started, that he'd get, you know, anyone even to the same table. He has, and it looks like that he will release something of a framework proposal or framework agreement, an American proposal that Israelis and Palestinians will sign on to, outlining what the final agreement will look like in relative detail. And it looks like he's going to release that very, very soon. So he is, in fact, making quite a significant amount of progress. At the same time, what you see are there's increasing sort of talk and consensus that if he fails, there is no possibility of a two-state solution anymore, which I think is going to make things quite difficult going forward. But that's sort of this emerging consensus that's increasingly echoed by mainstream voices, that they fear that this is the last best chance for peace via two-state solution. And I'm not sure what I think about that. I've heard that said many, many times before. The past
years,
and you keep coming back to partition and two-state solution over and over again. But it is significant, the voices who are chiming in that way now, and you have a growing movement that is calling to isolate Israel at this point, called the Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions Movement, which seems to be gaining some steam, particularly in European states and other parts of the world. So things are quite, the bottom line is that, there's real push on this issue right now. We may see something quite dramatic in the next few weeks. It will be termed as historic, but it's not going to be the end of the story. I think that story is just beginning. And some of the fundamentals of the conflict are shifting. How this breaks is anybody's best guess. I personally think that there will be a time, and I think we're nearing that time when we will be able to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict more as sort of a historical conflict in which we're dealing with sort of the consequences of a multi-generational conflict like that. But it's going to be an interesting ride.
I want to thank Greg Khalil for being my guest on Church and Culture today for this tremendous background of the conflict between Israel and Palestine and bringing us up to date. Greg, thanks for being on Church and Culture.
Thanks, Steele. It's my honor.
We ask all our listeners to join us next time.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. All young adults are invited to the Ann Arbor Chapter of Theology on Tap meeting Thursday, March 27th at Connor O'Neill's. This month's speaker is Paco Gavrilidi speaking on how to be a witness in the marketplace. His talk begins at 7. Come early to order some dinner. For further details, call 615-426-6947. The documentary film, The 40, will be screened at Madonna University in Livonia March 29th and 30th, and both screenings are open to the public. This film investigates the aftermath of abortion on our nation. Special guest Dr. Monica Miller will be attending both screenings. For more information, call 248-825-7395. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, avemariaradio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077.
Good day, I'm Al Cresta, inviting you to attend the Jackson St. Mary Star of the Sea Lenten Mission. It'll begin Sunday, March 23rd through Tuesday, March 25th, and I'll be the keynote speaker on Sunday night. Sister Sarah Burdick and Deacon Tom Lowy on Monday and Tuesday. Now remember, the Lenten Mission begins at 5:30 each night. There'll be a soup and salad supper. The presentations begin at 7. Call 517-416-5603. That's 517-416-5603.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
Christ the King Church in Ann Arbor titled their parish mission, Lord, That We Might See, the glory and majesty of the Church and our call to form in ourselves a Catholic worldview. Deacon Dan Foley preached the second evening.
Did you ever think that St. John, when he wrote in 1 John 19, we know that we are of God and the whole world is under the power of the evil one? Did you ever think about the fact that he wrote that after the cross and resurrection? He wrote that after the ascension? He wrote that after Pentecost? He was speaking to the early Christians in the situation after the victory of Easter, that there was still a battle to be won, and those words are just as true today as they were then.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Listen to Deacon Dan Foley with his parish mission talk, Keeping the World White Side Up, on Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Light of the East on Ave Maria, on this third Sunday of Lent, we venerate the cross, which stands in the middle between heaven and earth, but also in the middle of many Eastern Christian churches.
Saturday evenings at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
When we wonder